Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to our edition of the Ron and Don Show, coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, the Arctic wonderland of the North American continent, if you will. Of course, it's not as bad here as it's been out east, if you will. We had a snowstorm the other day that stretched from Nebraska to the southern part of Maine, if you will. That's well over 1,000 and some miles, my friends. That's got to be kind of frightening, if you will. Twin Cities got a lot of snow yesterday, a lot of accidents. People seem to think that the roads, quote-unquote, will look out for them, you know what I mean? They see all that ice and snow out there, and they drive like they're in a NASCAR race, you know what I mean? Like, some way or another, there's some kind of brake that will, you know, stop on more than a dime, if you will. That's why we have so many repair shops in America. They just rub their hands together when you get this inclement weather and et cetera. But anyways, a lot of things being discussed. I have a full program for you tonight. Co-host Don Allen is on academic assignment, if you will, getting it together, getting his head and thoughts together, if you will, you know, to be another Isaac Newton, if you know what I mean. We're going to talk a little bit about the Super Bowl, if you will. We're going to update on particularly Albert Lea, Minnesota, in which we did a piece on 2 weeks ago, tonight, if you will, as well as my column in the Spokesman Recorder, Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, where we talked in terms of situations in both Albert Lea and Duluth, Minnesota. Those two communities basically feeling isolated, but we will touch on that. But this is Black History Month, by the way, and we've probably been a little remiss in being a little bit more assertive, if you will, during the month of Martin Luther King Jr. But then, you know, there were so many celebrations of his life, I guess, if you will. But because we don't have a Black History Museum anywhere here in the state of Minnesota, we have to be dependent upon the white Minnesota Historical Society and Museum to kind of have a little corner somewhere in their museum where they, you know, have some artifacts, old newspaper clippings or something about the African-American. There are many, both black and white, who think that African-Americans came here around 1920, if you mean. Blacks were coming into the Minnesota territories when, you know, Minnesota was still a territory, if you will. In other words, we're talking as far back as 1715, 1720, when they were still talking about the French and Indian Wars and the British and all that. So there's been a presence of people of color, of the African-American experience, if you will, for a long time in Minnesota. But you don't know and can't follow our history because there's really not a great effort to incorporate it into the history books of Minnesota schools, if you will. And so we, quote-unquote, are ignored as the sons and daughters of the African in this state and other states, if you will. But then there are states that do much better with spotlighting, if you will, advancing, if you will, making known and paying homage and respect to the rich history of the sons and daughters of the African. Unfortunately, Minnesota is not one of those places, and in fact, we're going to touch taking a look at the Super Bowl on an article in this morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the largest newspaper here in the state of Minnesota, obviously white-owned. And they, I guess, called themselves on the sports page doing something about Black History Month. And they had a reference to a historical, you know, piece, an historical event, if you will, inside the National Football League. I guess the white folks just figured they could just take whatever it was they wanted to dream up and use an African-American, a Negro, to help them do it. But we're going to have to call the tech tonight on this program and just pay homage and respect to a African American first in the modern National Football League. We'll explain that a little bit later. But anyways, everybody's talking about the Super Bowl. You know, one of the things that we in Black America have hammered into us and beaten into us almost, you know, like 12 years a slave, is the brilliant mindset, if you will, of white people, you know, white folks, starting with the owners of the National Football League, you know, the front office stiffs, if you will, the general managers, and definitely the coaches and coordinators. And so we just, I guess some people just assume that the white mind is so advanced, if you will, so knowledgeable about quote-unquote athletics and football that, you know, there is not anything, any equation that they could not, you know, take a look at and correct and make effective. I mean, you know, they would, you know, take it and just do like a reverse. You know, in fact, Isaac Newton would have a real appreciation, I guess. But on this past Sunday in the Super Bowl, we saw something that was a little bit different to the extent of how to give a game away, but at the same time make money. And in fact, in our column in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, which will be out next week, this week's column deals with the racism in Albert Lea and Duluth, Minnesota. But in our column next week, we, you know, kind of take a look at the history of the National Football League, and it segues right into that just disastrous. I mean, let's just be, you know, real upfront, if you will. You know, I don't know what Pete Carroll, the head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, was thinking. I mean, he was clearly thinking because he had to know if he ran a certain play and turned the ball over with 52 seconds left at that particular point, that he was pretty much going to assure his team now, not the New England Patriots, but his team, of not successfully defending their Super Bowl championship of last year and not winning two in a row. And he probably would make a lot of people unhappy, and then he'd make a lot of people happy as it pertains to the point spread. You know, that's for you folks out there that, you know, bet, know how to bet, if you will, bet online, bet in Vegas, bet in Atlantic City, bet in Mississippi. I mean, you know and understand what it's all about, if you will. And when that play was run, if you will, they were less than a yard out of the end zone and taking lead and, you know, winning that game, if you will. I doubt if there would have been another miracle, quote-unquote, in Phoenix. And I looked at the face of Pete Carroll. I looked at the face of his players, particularly his black players, and you could kind of see the disgust. That's probably one of the reasons for the Donnybrook, if you will, the brief skirmish there as the New England Patriots, a very arrogant team, but also a team that cheats a lot, so they could understand when the fix is in, oops. And that little brief scuffle, that was really the frustration of some ball players, black and white, who had really put their heart and soul into the game and had an idiot for a coach and his offensive coordinator, and then the defensive coordinator didn't do a real tremendous job either. You know, you can always tell when a decision has been made and orders have been given to make sure that there are nothing but white heroes, if you will, in a big athletic contest. I mean, I know some folks would like to take exception with that, jump up and down, scream and holler, et cetera, but that's one of the advantages of having a bully pulpit, if you will, a platform, et cetera. You know, what do we care if you're upset? The facts are what they are, though. It's difficult to get around the facts. And so when Pete Carroll gave that call through his offensive coordinator, I assume that's how the signal came in from the sidelines, Russell Wilson unfortunately displayed something that Percy Harvin, who was jettisoned from the Seahawks in the middle of this past season, because he made some interesting comments about Russell Wilson kind of being, a front office man, if you will, or in some cases, wanting and liking being on the front porch of the plantation mansion, if you will, because in many ways, this big bowl game, and we've written about it a couple weeks ago after the National Collegiate Championship, in which Ohio State defeated a Oregon team that could barely find any black ball players from Oregon to be on the Oregon team. In fact, only 16 players on that Oregon team were from Oregon, if you will, but it's still, they made big money for the University of Oregon and for the betters and et cetera. Well, in the Super Bowl game, which, by the way, I mean, think about this figure, my friends, the NFL, the white owners, the white corporations, the white profiteers, and et cetera, made a little over $10 billion. That's $10 billion. That's a B, not an M, if you will. The owners probably will split, probably $250 million between them, if you will, or maybe a little less, but it'll certainly come out with certainly no less than $200 million for other franchises and the winners. The ball players probably received about one-fifth of that $10 billion in bonuses and salaries, if you will. But the key was we had our white heroes. We had Brady, if you will. Of course, we were going to have a white hero as a coach because there are hardly no African-Americans in the National Football League as head coaches. I mean, it's something we've talked about on this program periodically for the last couple of years. We talk about it in our column. We talk about it in our television program and et cetera, emanating here from the Twin Cities. In fact, the number of black head coaches in the National Football League is shrinking, just like there's basically non-existent in the major sports arena of college football, if you will. And by the way, there are a lot of college teams that are really worth a lot of money when you talk about their stadium sizes and revenues and concessions and all of that. In fact, the richest college franchise, if you will, as we reported in our column last week, is actually Ohio State at about $1.2 billion. $1.2 billion. If you were able to sell Ohio State like you sell a team in the professional sports arena, be it football, basketball, baseball, hockey, if you will, Ohio State would fetch $1.2 billion. Now, it's not something we made up. White man, who's a professor at Indiana University, who gets, paid and has tenure at Indiana University, is paid to come up with these figures and crunch the numbers. The second most lucrative, quote-unquote, collegiate franchise would be Michigan at $993 million, if you will, just about $7 million less than a billion. And so when you look at that, and, of course, we all know the story of collegiate America, basically if we can get one-third of the African-American scholared athletes to graduate in the required time, whatever that is, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 7 years, 8 years. About a third of them, if they're real lucky, and there are some colleges that they will never get out of and never get their degrees. Their white counterparts on the field of competition and in the programs will basically stay up right around 60%. Getting their degrees, if you will, and moving on to very, 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 very lucrative jobs, not really the same. In fact, if the average and above average African-American playing collegiate sports, for particularly the so-called big super teams or super PACs, if they don't get a fairly decent contract in the National Football League, because there's no playing overseas and et cetera, it's not like the National Basketball Association or the Negro Basketball Association, as some white folks like to say. there's really, you know, no real development league per se. So if you don't, in football, if you don't get something, get invited, get drafted, or, you know, if you're unrestricted, you know, free agent or et cetera, you may pick up $300,000 or $400,000. In fact, isn't it interesting? Russell Wilson led Seattle to a Super Bowl win last year, if you will, and yet this young man was only being paid about $600,000. Again, I think we understand some of the friction that emerged between he and Percy Harvin and in the locker room and et cetera. So they got rid of Percy. Of course, Percy did have a nice contract. He had gotten out and done what he needed to do. But I was a little surprised that after winning a Super Bowl last year for Seattle, particularly given that the owner of the Seattle franchise is a billionaire, I mean, you know, wasn't going to hurt his pocket, that they were, you know, at least take Russell Wilson, a winning Super Bowl quarterback, you know, up to at least, of, you know, $1.3 or $4 million to pay him. But they decided not to do that. He will have a base salary, by the way, according to all the reliable sources, USA Today and et cetera, of about $983,000 next year. The boy still won't be making $1 million. And yet he has gone two consecutive Super Bowls, won one, and his coach lost the second one, if you will, even though Russell threw the pass into the middle of the pack. We keep looking at our production team. We keep looking at the still pictures of that pass. There were like, you know, five ball players standing, you know, within a 2.5-yard circle. Nobody throws that kind of pass. I don't care what kind of genius you think you are, Pete Carroll. But the bookies, the people that make money off of professional sports, put the fix in, make sure that the numbers go the right way, the plays go the right way, and et cetera, they're going to make the money that, you know, needs to be made. Some are saying tonight in Las Vegas that was a $50 million decision. That's a pretty, you know, healthy number, if you will, that pass caused $50 million to change hands, quote-unquote, in a period of how, you know, long it took Russell Wilson to take the snap, step back a little bit, and throw the ball right over the middle. You know, you throw a pass like that, you throw it to the outside. If you're going to throw into the middle of the end zone in a play like that, you at least throw it to the back end of the end zone. So, you know, maybe it sails out of bounds and et cetera. You got two more downs to use one of the most effective short yardage running backs, Mr. Lynch. But then the NFL and Roger Goodell did not like Mr. Lynch. Mr. Lynch does not, you know, scratch and bend and grin for the white media, the white fourth estate here in America. He did it last year. This year, you know, last year he was fined, I don't know what, $25,000. This year, boss Goodell said, you know, Negro, you either talk, say something, you know, eat peanuts or do something, or we will fine you $500,000. I just don't think that is not only fair, I just don't think it's really legal, even though the Players Association unfortunately gave the NFL, the plantation head, the latitude to threaten to impose that kind of fine on Mr. Lynch. But think about it. I mean, you know, white man says to you, you will talk to my white press corps, if you will. You will entertain them, you know what I mean? You'll buck and wing and et cetera. Mr. Lynch, who is a native of Oakland, a very, very intelligent young African-American, number one, just as Richard Sherman, who is of a similar background and exceptional pedigree, if you will, who showed last year that all Negroes are not impressed by blonde-headed white women who try to make fools out of them, if you will. Richard Sherman made fools out of everybody. So when the decision came down to handing the ball off to one of the best short yardage runners in the NFL. The bosses said, do not give that Negro the ball. Throw the ball over the middle, and let's hope for, quote-unquote, what actually took place. You throw a ball like that in a situation in which you're just a little less than a yard from the goal line and victory and your second consecutive Super Bowl win, which certainly would have been worth, oh, my God, at least $1 billion to the Seattle franchise and et cetera. And you throw that – well, first of all, you call that kind of play and then you want to convince us in Black America that y'all are the most talented, if you will, white America, if you will. You're the most talented, if you will. You're the most insightful, if you will. Now, you may be the most corrupt, if you will. Again, like we said, that pass from Russell Wilson to somebody on the New England Patriots team, that was a $50 million pass. I mean, the bets and et cetera that had already been laid, just clearly, you know, New England was to win that game. The point spread and et cetera, you know, some folks are talking about it, but the media is more concerned with keeping our mind focused, refocused back the other way now, talking in terms of what's happening in the Middle East, a Jordanian Air Force fighter pilot who knew what he was doing, you know, from the comfort of his jet. Jet got shot down. ISIL or ISIS got a hold of him. Negotiations went on. Oh, yeah, we believe in putting a little bit of, you know, political flavor into sports because it is sports that keeps us hypnotized, if you will. And I love sports. I mean, I am a thoroughbred, you know, very appreciative Black man of the fact that, you know, that we have something to entertain us or we would go stone crazy, if you will. But the fact of the matter is that the folks change this like they change a dial, and so now, you know, our interest is supposed to be back to a Jordanian fighter pilot who was apparently burnt to death, if you will, and then two alleged terrorists, one a woman, 40-year-old woman, were hung as a revenge, yes, revenge and retaliation. But it was the Super Bowl. Because while the fighting goes on in the Middle East with ISIS or ISIL, if you will, and Al-Qaeda, if you will, and, you know, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Syria, if you will, Hezbollah, if you will, Hamas, if you will, the Jewish state, oh, that's right, at least the Jews do have a state. The Palestinians are still waiting on theirs. I mean, those things were going on, but we were being entertained by some of the greatest stupidity that professional sports or any sports has ever known. And Pete Carroll, you know, is a man who clearly, notice the word we are getting ready to use, aided and abetted. He aided and abetted a crime, if you will, really, and based on what he did. It'll be interesting to see what his relationship, he being Pete Carroll's relationship, will be with his players next year, particularly his Black players, particularly in light of what happened with regards to the Percy Harvin controversy, a great pass receiver and runner and kick returner, et cetera, who was let out or traded to the New York Jets in the middle of the season. That was interesting. But there was a lot of tension and strife inside of the Seattle locker room for at least a brief period of time, but leaders within the Seattle Seahawks team, such as Mr. Wagner, if you will, Mr. Chancellor, if you will, and certainly Mr. Sherman and others, you know, stepped up, said, let's get ourselves refocused here. Let's do what we know we can do, and that is we can win, and we can win the Super Bowl. Pete Carroll and the fixers, the people that really bet the big money, I'm not talking about the small peanuts gambler who bet $3,000 or $4,000, if you will, or $100 or $50, or the people who had the little pool tabs sitting in their living rooms around America betting on the points, if you will, 7-1, 8-1, if you will, 0-0, and et cetera. No, I'm talking about the people that really handle the big money, make the decision on life and, well, yes, it is, on life and death, if you will. So we can believe some of the scuttlebutt coming out of Las Vegas, Nevada, that was a $50 million call, if not more, but definitely $50 million, based on what the gamblers, I'm talking about, again, the real gamblers, the real people that know what the hell is going on, what they were expecting to have happen, it happened. Now, to the question of, quote unquote, making sure that America stays focused and stays white, if you will. You know, they said that Pete Carroll was trying to get Russell Wilson the MVP award. I don't think so. Tom Brady was the MVP when he threw that first deflated football in the game against Indianapolis, if you will. I feel bad for the Colts, though. The Colts have an interesting history right now. They have an owner who's one of the biggest crackheads in the National Football League. You know, he's probably driving around right now in Indianapolis smoking and sucking on a pipe and smoking that dope. I'm talking about the owner, Isa. I'm talking about the owner of the Indianapolis Colts. And everybody knows that. I mean, it's free discussion, if you will, in the offices, if you will, in the boardrooms of the National Football League. And by the way, National Football League ownership is a closed group. I mean, you know, for folks that talk in terms of African Americans coming a long way, let's do a little piece of history, because this is Black History Month. You know, this is our month, I guess, though half the time these folks can't get the history correct and right. Let's take a look at the National Football League. Been in business for a long time. Actually, in fact, at one time, it was some outstanding Black ball players that helped kind of get people interested in watching, particularly even back in that day, fairly good-sized men run around and hit each other and et cetera. In fact, one of the greatest of all times was Paul Robeson, who actually made his claim to fame by being one of the greatest orators, if you will, actors, singers, just a Renaissance man. For those of you that understand the definition of Renaissance, a man of exceptional intellectual gift and et cetera. So Paul Robeson had very much been proclaimed way back in the day. We're talking now 1911, 1912, 1913. Later, because Paul Robeson spoke out against, racism and segregation in America, he was branded a communist, if you will. But he was respected, key word, respected and appreciated in Europe and Russia and places like that, and certainly in some of the halls of entertainment and enlightenment here in the United States, Paul Robeson. But Paul Robeson was an All-American. In fact, a guy by the name Walter Camp, who was the man that selected who it was a All-American back in those days. We're talking now 1904, 1905, you know. We had a great player right here out of Minnesota. You don't even hear about him because, again, we don't have any point of reference as Black people, because we don't have a Black museum, if you will, sports or otherwise. His name was Bobby Marshall, if you will. He was one talented athlete, could play four or five or six or seven different sports at a world level back in those days, right up there with the great Jim Thorpe, one of the greatest athletes ever to live, who unfortunately for history was a Indian, Native American, if you will, indigenous person, if you will, and et cetera. And actually, America went to the lengths of stripping him of his gold medals because he was a red man. He was a Native American. He was an Indian. He was an indigenous person. Same thing with Bobby Marshall out of St. Paul, Minnesota, if you will, and similarly with the great Paul Robeson. And there were others, if you will. And Minnesota had a couple more after that, and et cetera. But anyways, the National Football League was segregated at the end of the 1933 season. This is a little bit of history for those of you that say that you're interested in history as we move a little bit after the 9 o'clock hour. And there were a couple of white owners in the National Football League. One of them was a man by the name of Hallis. George Halas of the Chicago Bears. Everybody says he's a great man because he said nice things about Gale Sayers and then Walter Payton, if you will, but that really wasn't George. George Halas was just a pure racist, if you will, and he displayed that during the 1930, or actually leading into the 1933 season, when he and a real racist named George Preston Marshall, who changed the name of his Washington team to the Washington Redskins because he thought there was something cute about that, if you will. There's still controversy about that, but the owner, Snyder of the Washington Skins, has always said that he doesn't think there's anything wrong with the Washington Redskins name. I've always said, and have said it in my columns and et cetera, that if Ms. Gilbert is so enamored with that rationale and logic, then why doesn't he name it for his own people and just call it the Washington Kikes, if you will? You know what I mean? That's a very derogatory term for Jews, you know, and just show his appreciation for his own lineage and history, but he wouldn't do that. But anyways, before the 1933 season, as it pertains to the history of the National Football League, George Halas and George Preston Marshall got together with the other seven or eight owners of the National Football League and said, look, we need to be in line with what the other professional sport, because the most popular sport in America at that time was baseball, whereas now we're told that it is football who is America's sport. I guess Jerry Jones of the very questionable Dallas Cowboys felt very strongly about the fact that, you know, America's team should be crafted, if you will, shaped and painted in the form of white America kind of things. Well, back in 1933, that was a discussion that was going on, and the owners, the Giants, the Titans, the movers and shakers of the National Football League said, we need to come in line with the social demands, if you will, and segregate professional football as professional baseball is segregated. Negroes were no longer allowed to play. In fact, Negroes actually had been banned almost 20 years before from playing in the national or the major leagues, if you will. Think about that. They were African Americans, Negroes, you know, as they were referred to, were actually thrown out of the game of baseball even before the First World War, but were still, you know, expected to go serve America and her democratic institutions, which makes you wonder what were those institutions. But back to 1933. So in 1933 meeting in Chicago, the all-white owners, think about that now, the all-white owners of the National Football League voted to put a covenant into the constitution and bylaws of the National Football League and indicate that after the 1933 season, by the way, by that time there were only about two Negroes that were still being carried on the roster of National Football League teams. Again, this is 1933. And the Constitution and the covenant said that after the 1933 season, Negroes would not be allowed to take the field with white players in any game involving the National Football League. And after the 1933 season, the only team that still had a Negro player left were the Chicago Cardinals. That's right, Chicago Cardinals, not to be confused with the later to be St. Louis Cardinals and now the Arizona Cardinals. That's where the Cardinals actually came from. Some people can still remember 1950 and the great Ollie Mattson, if you will, one of the greatest ball players in the history of the National Football League, and certainly the then Chicago Cardinals, later to be the St. Louis Cardinals, now to be the Arizona Cardinals. And so with the end of the 1933 season, a running back by the name of, I think his name was Ray Anderson, if you will, was told that he would not be allowed to play, nor would a contract be offered to him. And so from the 1934 season right on through the Second World War, think about that, Second World War, young Negroes, young African Americans were dying right with their white counterparts in the Pacific and in Europe and et cetera in defense of, there it was again, of democracy. Isn't history ironic? And so after the war ended, April 1945, dropped a couple you know, hydrogen bombs or atomic bombs, as they called them, on the little yellow Japs, if you will. I mean, that's how they referred to them. Peace came to the world. There again, the irony of history. 1945, you know, people, Harry Truman, who had succeeded the fallen Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who had died, if you will, longest serving president in the history of the Republic. And so people wanted to get back. You know, they wanted to, well, first of all, they had to come up with the Marshall Plan to get Europe back on its feet, you know, needed to take care of their white cousins and things like that. Get them back in stride, if you will, get their economy back. So they came up with the Marshall Plan, that was actually named for George C. Marshall, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, five-star general, along with a man by the name of Dwight Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower later, of course, became president of the United States. In 1946, a conference called the American Football Conference raised up and indicated that it was going to challenge the National Football League. And one of the reasons was that so many of America's black native sons had come back home and, you know, needed things to do. And first of all, these were trained military individuals, a whole lot more than you had coming back home after the First World War, if you will. And so things needed to be done. America needed to change. Harry Truman, you know, was talking about doing some things. By 1948, Harry Truman had said, we're going to integrate. Can you think about that? Can you believe that, with the exception of the Navy, which had always kind of been integrated because it's difficult to segregate people when you put them on a ship and they have to sleep together, serve together, fight together, if you will. But in 1948, Harry Truman said, look, we're going to integrate the armed forces of America. Well, in 1946, a man by the name of Paul Brown, one of the most outstanding coaches in the history of America, if you will, first at Massillon High School in Ohio, one of the great high school coaches, and then later at Ohio State, one of the great college coaches, and then later as the founder and owner of first what was called the Cleveland Rams, and then actually wound up being called for him, being called the Cleveland Browns, if you will. But where Paul Brown considered to be a problem was that he said, we're going to use a vast talent that we have not used in professional football since 1933. It's called the Negro. And so Paul Brown, this is all a part of black history that people don't even talk about. And so Paul Brown integrated his team, a couple of other teams, the so-called New York Titans, if you will, a couple of us that were coming out in the little cities, the Boston Braves. Yes, there used to be a football team called the Boston Braves there in Boston, if you will. And so the Negro came onto the full field of competition, people like Lenny Ford, if you will. And let me deal with one that we talked about at the top of the program. In this morning's edition of the paper here in my hometown of Minneapolis, Minnesota, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, on the sports page, there is this piece that, you know, supposedly touches on that brief moment in black history in America. And some very fine and Hall of Fame African American former Vikings, Minnesota Vikings football team, which at one point in time has had two black coaches, which makes it a little bit out of the norm, if you will. You know, most teams, with the exception of Oakland, basically have had no more than one kind of thing. You know what I'm saying? But anyways, in this morning's edition of the paper, a former player named Greg Coleman of the Minnesota Vikings allowed a statement to be made that he was the first full-time punter for the Vikings, and first and foremost the most for the National Football League. He was the first Negro that was actually hired and paid to kick a football, punt a football of all times. And I saw that and I was saddened by it as a historian, because that's not factual, that's not the truth. And as an associate of mine on the West Coast said earlier this evening, when you see blunders like that, just kind of like, you know, the play calling by Pete Carroll, the brilliant white coach of the Seattle Seahawks, takes place, you see those kind of blunders and you wonder how many other things have been, quote unquote, misrepresented, if you will, not represented, not told, not told factually and accurately and et cetera in white America's historical, quote unquote, portrayal of the black race. And so I was well remembered because as a young Negro, if you will, after the Second World War, I could well remember watching the outstanding Cleveland Brown team specifically because they had more Negroes on them in 1948, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53 than any other team in the National Football League. And by the way, by 1948, the Cleveland Rams, now the Cleveland Browns, had joined the NFL. And so, by the way, in 1950, 54 and 55, the Cleveland Browns were the champions of the National Football League. But Cleveland had a superb, well, they had a number of superb athletes. Some of them we've already named, Lynn Ford and others. But one of the greatest and one of the most unique, and a man that made many of us young Negroes of that particular area, as we played in the parks and the backyards of America, we all wanted to be Horace Gillum. For you folks on the computers, if you will, it's spelled G-I-L-L-O-M. He was born March 1921. He passed from this life in 1985. He was finally inducted into the National Football League Hall of Fame. He played for the Cleveland Browns for 10 years. 10 years he played. His punting average never went below 41 yards a kick, and that was when the football was shaped a little bit differently, though it wasn't deflated like the New England Patriots have a tendency to do. But Horace Gillum was one of the greatest punters the game had ever known. And so it bothered me as a black historian, as we go into the last 15 minutes of this evening's program, to see that kind of misrepresentation in a white newspaper attempting to talk in terms and make us black folk have an appreciation of what them white folks know about our history. And I was disappointed that Greg Coleman, an African-American who does color commentary for the Vikings Network, would let that go by and get by and not actually move to sanitize it, if you will, because that was a disrespect to Horace Gillum, who was an All-American high school player and one of the greatest at Massillon High School, played at Ohio State, went into the service to serve his country, finished his college career at the University of Nevada at Reno, if you will, and then joined the man who, and this was ironic because Paul Brown coached Horace Gillum in high school, in college at Ohio State, and for 10 years with the Cleveland Browns. And so there was a great relationship there, both of them coming out of Massillon, Ohio. And so I just think that just taking a name, if you will, that has been once again disrespected by history, we chose tonight to pray and praise Horace Gillum, one of the greatest punters in the history of the National Football League, which meant that he was a punter long before. In fact, he was a punter probably before Greg Coleman was born, if you will, a man who passed this life in 1985. And so maybe at some point the Star Tribune, National Football League, who let that garbage get by, even old brother Greg Coleman, will apologize to the heirs and the friends and the loved ones of Horace Gillum, give him his respect and his deference, if you will, because he joined the legendary Paul Robeson, one of America's greatest sons, if you will, black or white, and actually being, you know, one of the great punters of the game. As we said at the top of this program, Paul Robeson was just one of the finest all-around athletes that you would ever want to see. So that is kind of the history, if you will, as they talk about the NFL and professional sports, and people are all talking and still arguing about one of the dumbest plays, but yet probably one of the most profitable plays in the history of the game. As we said, that pass was a $50 million turnaround, if you will, made a lot of white folks a lot of money who had come in betting that mafia money out of Boston, if you will, the so-called home of the New England Patriots, if you will. It's too bad that in some regards, that Russell Wilson would have proved Percy Harvin wrong about the fact that Russell does probably have a tendency to be, quote-unquote, a little bit more the front office's colored guy than maybe he should be. Russell Wilson has enough skill and definitely has enough intelligence that he should have contemplated what that call was going to mean to the hard work done by his teammates and his colleagues, and particularly for black football players in the National Football League who have taken a hell of a whipping this year, if you will, from the powers to be, starting, you know, with Ray Rice and our own Adrian Peterson, if you will, and a couple of others that have, quote-unquote, been taught a lesson. Josh Gordon, I see, suspended once again. Now, Mazzell, the gifted young white quarterback out of Texas A&M, who everybody knew was a crackhead, very quietly says that he's, after having a miserable rookie season, everyone said, well, we're just going to, he's going to go into rehab, but we don't want to talk about why he's going into rehab. Well, you talked about Ray Rice, you talked about Adrian Peterson, you talked about every black player, including Josh Gordon, also of the Cleveland Browns, who, quote-unquote, was suspended for a full year this time. This is actually three strikes. I doubt if he'll ever, Josh Gordon, who is tremendous talent, will ever get back into professional football. But, boy, no one had a problem, you know, talking about and fully exposing what these black men had done wrong. And Johnny Mazzell is no different. Oh, yes, he is. I'm sorry, because he has that beautiful white skin, as does Tom Brady, if you will, who the decision had already been made that he would be the most valuable player. Because certainly if Russell Wilson would have been able to throw a touchdown pass into the end zone other than where he threw it, or he would have went ahead and legged it in, because he had been running a couple of excellent option plays, if you will. That's where you put the ball in the belly of the runner, if you will, pull it back, and you continue around the corner and into the end zone from a yard out. But the decision, just like with Hollywood, the decision had already been made that, you know, we're coming to the end of the term, if you will, of the colored president, Barack Obama. You know, we've had enough of, you know, Negroes in the White House, if you will, and having to listen to this black rhetoric. And so even Hollywood sent a signal this year by saying that there were no black stars, no black actors or actresses or et cetera, and that whatever recognition you're really going to get it over there at the Golden Globes or something like that, where you're singing and dancing and entertaining us white folks, you know, kind of thing. And so kind of a message is being sent, by the way, as we move into the political arena over the next couple of weeks. You're going to watch the Congress show President Barack Obama how much disdain and hatred they have for him, if you will. In fact, on this particular sojourn, they're going to be joined by some white Democrats who, you know, have been told back in their home district that it's okay to go on and show your true colors. It's going to be a tough 2 years for President Barack Obama. We just hope that God's hand continues to be on his shoulder for the purpose of the safety of his family and particularly his family, his beautiful daughters, his beautiful wife, and et cetera. In fact, as we come down to the last 6 minutes of tonight's program, actually 10 minutes, don't you find it interesting on how many of these test runs have been made to penetrate? Think about it, my friends, those of you that say you're security conscious. Penetrate the security of the White House. I mean, we've had people just run, jump over the fence. Ain't that, that's amazing. Run across the lawn. Nobody releases the dogs. I mean, they have some attacks dogs that are under the control of the uniformed Secret Service that can take you down. Guy jumps over the fence. Another guy just runs through the gate guardhouse, if you will, just runs into the White House and up the stairs. If he'd have made the right turn, he'd have been right off into President and Miss Obama's bedroom. Luckily, they had already left on the helicopter, I think, for Camp David. We have drones being flown in. It's a good cover story, too, that the individual who flew the latest drone into a small drone, I mean, a small drone about the size of a child's big fire truck, if you will. And, you know, it was interesting what he said. He said he was drunk and he was drinking at some club somewhere along Constitution Avenue or whatever, or block, or Avenue H or Avenue M or Avenue F, if you will. And he just decided, I guess, to go to the car, take his drone out, fire it up, and send it up over into the yard outside of the White House. In fact, we don't know that the plane actually, in fact, did not hit the White House. Now, what's troubling about that and where we're coming from on tonight's program on this particular issue is what we said just seconds, well, minutes ago, we repeat again. Aren't you kind of curious about these penetrations, if you will, that are taking place, testing the security of the White House and testing the future, if you will, of the President of the United States and his life expectancy, if you will. Well, quickly on notes, you know, people are still talking about the situation at Green Central. We want to discuss that when my associate is back and we will have the phone lines open. It is quite obvious that the school district, I tell you, you people at 1250 West Broadway are mean-spirited. It is quite obvious that you intend to destroy Ms. Cruz by any means necessary, and you intend to do everything that you can. You people, again, you educators at 1250 West Broadway. That, by the way, for our audience outside of Minneapolis and around the nation, 1250 West Broadway is the address of the school district's beautiful, beautiful headquarters. Oh, it looks like the Taj Mahal, a palace built without black labor. And hired on black folk to work on that thing. Took them 3 years to build it. But it is quite clear that folks have made their minds up that they are going to destroy, by any means necessary, Miss Lorraine Cruz, the principal who has been placed on leave from Green Central. The kind of allegations and innuendos that some of you, including associate superintendents and et cetera, have been putting out about her, if you will, about this woman of color who toiled for 18 years in the Chicago Public Schools as first a teacher and then administrator, principal, and et cetera. It's interesting to watch people and to watch how mean-spirited a city is, if you will, at certain institutions, as we are basically in the last 6 minutes of tonight's program. It's fascinating to watch how people enjoy hurting people. And I've asked the question over the last 10 days, is Ms. Cruz, is she committed to the education of the children? Because that's really what it's supposed to be about. And people will say yes, that she is very much committed to the education and the caring of the children. And I said, well, shouldn't that count for something? And then I am reminded, as an African-American, that Justice Taney said it many years ago, 1859, that there are no rights, moral considerations, if you will, that should be afforded and accorded to the Negro, if you will, the sons and daughters of the African, that the Caucasian should have any concern about, and that by any means necessary, once again, a theme of the 1960s and 70s, that it really doesn't make any difference that if they can destroy a person of color in quote-unquote dismantling their areas of responsibility, in this case, a young woman who wants to educate and cares about the education of the children of the sons and daughters of Africa, if that means destroying her and, by extension, denying them, if you will, then so be it. And so that's what we have seen in this city. Someone asked me the other day, do you think that there will be a black and brown coalition, in other words, of African Americans and Latino, Hispanics, and et cetera? And I said, I don't think so. I've already seen leaders in the Latino, Hispanic community begin to make statements relevant to Ms. Cruz can be sacrificed. And then in the case of the African Americans, they're so busy trying to get money from Governor Mark Dayton, by any means necessary, if you will, that they don't have time for, quote-unquote, the salvation, if you will, of their own race and their own species. There used to be a time, in closing, when it was a badge of honor. Boy, you used to hear back in the 1950s and 60s, older black Americans, if you will, who would identify those black Americans who were fighting for the rights of the sons and daughters of the African as race people, that she was a race woman, he was a race man. That was a badge of honor. It talked in terms that one was committed. And think about it now. This is appropriate for discussion because the white folks have given us the months of January and February, get it out of the way at the top of the year, to talk about, quote-unquote, the place within the broader society of the Negro race, if you will. And so kind of January and February, we're allowed to, quote-unquote, talk in terms. I don't know if it's expectations anymore that we're allowed to even think about. It's just something that folks feel like they can do in the cold months, if you will. And, you know, we've had a pretty brutal winter all throughout this nation, per se, if you will. And so it's just kind of like people kind of cuddling up, you know, in front of a warm fire, you know. Of course, in the African-American communities, the fire normally comes, unfortunately, from a space heater because your heat, et cetera, has been cut off since October 15th, if you will. And so you're just to be happy and complacent, if you will, and comfortable with what it is that is being afforded to you. But as it pertains to the intellectual minds, if you will, to those that analyze and make determinations and judgments, quote-unquote, about the future and the safety of the African-American, as far as they're concerned, it must be business as usual, that we must move on and et cetera. In fact, that's probably one of the reasons why I've noticed that we haven't heard a lot of discussions about a lot of events for Black History Month, if you will. In fact, I'm hearing more and more discussion about a kind of a movement that says, you know, we've listened enough to the Negroes, if you will, to the Black Americans, whatever that's supposed to mean. There are other immigrants and et cetera that have come to these beautiful free shores. A lot of people, immigrants, by the way, after arriving here, find out that it's not as free and comfortable and quote-unquote accommodating as they saw on television or in comic books or their friends told them. But one can dream, and to live out the American dream, one must remember that one must make significant sacrifices and that one really should never expect to be a part of the upper 4 to 5 percentile economically, if you will. That's unreasonable. But one can expect to be accepted, not necessarily appreciated, but accepted as a part of a workforce that continues to make white America wealthy and continues to widen the gap of poverty, particularly. And we should not apologize as the sons and daughters of the black African, that black Americans have paid the supreme price and have earned the right at a table in these United States of America. Well, we will be back next Wednesday. Our colleague, Mr. Allen, will be joining us, if you will. He will be completing his academic assignments and et cetera. Phone lines will be open once again. If not, if he is unable to join us next week, we think we will talk in terms of some of the proposals that some of our leaders are making to get some more money to get them through the year, not to get the community through the year, but to get them through the year. On behalf of my co-host, Mr. Donald Allen, I am Ron Edwards, and this is the Ron and Don Show, coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul.